From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
The Indonesian army converged in two places.
Hundreds and hundreds of troops coming straight at the Timorese.
When they came, they opened fire.
10 years ago today, the Indonesian military opened fire on defenseless Timorese, killing more than 250 of them. Abortion clinics in the Midwest and Northeast received more than 200 anthrax threats. At the WTO meeting in Qatar, poor countries demand the U.S. put human rights over patent rights of drug companies as thousands protest around the world. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan is the second. I'm Amy Goodman. Opposition forces claiming to have the ruling Taliban on the run press their drive in northeastern Afghanistan this weekend. The opposition Northern Alliance, backed by intense U.S. bombing and logistical support from British and U.S. special forces on the ground, has moved steadily across northern Afghanistan since occupying the strategic city of Mazar-Sharif on Friday. As they appear to cement their control of northern cities, Northern Alliance commanders have discussed a possible offensive against the capital city of Kabul. This as U.S. bombers continue to carpet bomb Taliban positions north of the city. U.S. officials have told the alliance to stay out of the capital while they pursue discussions with alliance officials as well as Pakistan and other neighboring countries on what kind of administration to install there. But officials of the Northern Alliance have rejected arguments they're unwelcome in Kabul, which was taken by the Taliban in 1996 after fighting among Northern Alliance warlords from 1992 to 96 reduced the city to rubble and killed tens of thousands of civilians. A vote-by-vote review of untallied ballots in the 2000 Florida presidential election indicates that George W. Bush would have lost Florida and therefore the presidency had Al Gore pursued and gained a complete statewide recount. The new data, compiled by the Associated Press and seven other news organizations, suggests that Gore followed a legal strategy after Election Day that would have led to defeat even if the U.S. Supreme Court had not intervened to effectively give the state to Bush. Gore sought a recount of a relatively small portion of the state's disputed ballots, while the review indicates his only chance lay in a course he advocated publicly but did not pursue in court, a full statewide recount of all Florida's untallied votes. The media consortium hired the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago to view each untallied ballot and gather information about how it was marked. The consortium used computers to sort and tabulate votes based on varying scenarios that had been raised during the post-election scramble in Florida. Completing two partial recounts that Gore unsuccessfully pursued in court showed Bush maintaining a lead ranging from 225 and 493 votes, meaning Bush still would have won if the U.S. Supreme Court had allowed a partial statewide recount to continue. But under any standard that tabulated all disputed votes statewide, Gore erased Bush's advantage and emerged with a tiny lead that ranged from 42 to 171 votes. The media consortium found that Gore outpolled Bush under all six scenarios for counting all undervotes and overvotes statewide. The consortium delayed releasing the results of this study for over a month as the U.S. launched the attacks on Afghanistan. The Washington Post is reporting that the American Red Cross collected hundreds of thousands of blood donations after September 11th, knowing the blood could not be used for victims of the terrorist attacks. After selling some of the surplus blood to hospitals, the Red Cross has begun to destroy thousands of pints that have outlasted their shelf life. Directors of several Red Cross blood centers said their sites may discard as many as one of every five donations, and the national total could easily reach tens of thousands. Although the Red Cross told the public that surplus blood would be frozen, it did not have the resources to freeze large amounts of excess blood, this according to documents and interviews. The Red Cross decisions in the days after September 11th created a standoff with other blood groups which opposed collecting unneeded supplies of a perishable product. Federal officials tried to negotiate a unified policy, but the Red Cross balked at a plan to encourage donors to delay their donations. The Red Cross has already come under intense criticism after it announced that it would be using more than 40% of the more than $500 million it's raised since September 11th to meet its own needs rather than the needs of victims and their families. President George Bush made his first speech at the United Nations this weekend, warning world leaders they were either with the U.S. in its so-called war on terrorism or against it. While everyone who spoke at the UN meeting condemned the September 11th attacks, many world leaders also expressed their opposition to the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan. Saudi Arabia's Prince Faisal also slammed the Bush administration for its backing of Israel and Bush's equation of Palestinian resistance to Israeli occupation as terrorism, saying, quote, "It's enough to make a sane man go mad." And South African President Thabo Mbeki said it was obvious that the fundamental conflict in the world today is the deprivation of millions, quote, coexisting side by side with islands of enormous wealth and prosperity.
Time is running out. Time is running out. There is thunder.
Time is running out, Wendy Smith, here on the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. Federal Express packages containing white powder and the threat, "This contains anthrax, you're going to die," arrived at more than 200 Midwest and East Coast abortion clinics on Thursday. The packages sent overnight from drop boxes in Virginia and Philadelphia marked the second mass mailing signed by the Army of God, an elusive group of anti-abortion activists who in the past have claimed responsibility for the murder of doctors who perform abortions and for the bombing of clinics. On the armyofgod.com website, the featured quote of the month is, "I'm an abortionist bomber, that's what I do," from Clayton Wagner, an anti-abortion extremist on the FBI's top 10 list of most wanted criminals. The mailings come less than a month after more than 250 similar letters were sent to women's health clinics in envelopes through the postal system. Because there have been so many anthrax threats against abortion clinics in the last 3 years, abortion rights groups have developed routines for notifying all clinics of the threats that have been received, and most are careful to screen their mail. Shortly after the first anthrax packages arrived at the National Abortion Federation in Washington on Thursday, they received a bomb threat and evacuated the building for more than an hour. Authorities testing the powder do not believe it contains anthrax or other toxins. But directors of Planned Parenthood, the National Abortion Federation, the Feminist Majority Foundation have requested a meeting with Attorney General John Ashcroft and Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge. We're joined now by Kodrak McCullough, who is an abortion provider at the Feminist Health Center in New Hampshire. She opened one of the FedEx packages last week. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you. Can you tell us what happened? When did you receive it?
We received the FedEx envelope about 9:30 in the morning last Thursday, and all mail is handled under strict protocol now at the health center as well as clinics across the nation. And the envelope was given to myself The address, the return address, as you have mentioned, was the National Abortion Federation, and I did not recognize a name above the return address, Cynthia Waters, though she was a clinic director at another clinic in a different part of the country. I handled it as suspicious mail, opened the package outside of the facility with latex gloves and a mask, found a number 10 envelope within the FedEx mailer that contained an off-white powdery substance on the top of the flap of the envelope, immediately shut it, and initiated our protocol for anthrax threat letters.
And what is that?
That is contacting organizations such as the National Abortion Federation, the National Coalition of Abortion Providers, the Feminist Majority, local and state and federal officials such as our fire marshals, the police, FBI, hazardous material teams, let everybody know right away what was going on. And we have an incredibly supportive, we're really lucky, incredibly supportive local police and fire, and they came immediately and helped us handle the situation with as little fanfare as possible.
How did you feel?
I definitely felt glad that I have had the training in handling suspicious mail and that I had the instincts to open it up outside of the facility. I felt proud of kind of the instincts that I had in that moment. But I also did have a small sense of fear and dread seeing that powder on the top of the envelope, but was able to handle it with just a sense of I knew how to handle the situation.
In the last month, when there were other anthrax hoaxes, the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, spoke specifically about them, said people would be prosecuted to the full extent of the law, that hoaxes were extremely serious and were crimes. I remember a Connecticut building that was cleared out, but I did not hear him mention women's health clinics. And I'm wondering what has happened since last Thursday. Still, even before that, there was another rash of these letters. Is that right? A few weeks ago, right at the time of CBS and NBC mainly, where more than 100 clinics got these letters.
Right. I understand that in the month of October, 280 anthrax hoax letters were sent out. So it was interesting that there wasn't as much attention to that rash of mailings as there is this one. Now, whether authorities are taking it more seriously because they were mailed FedEx and there might be a better chance of tracking the senders, I'm not sure if that's what it is, or finally tolerance for domestic terrorism there's been an intolerance for this type of behavior.
What is the Attorney General doing? He's a well-known anti-abortion activist. He has said in the past that his most proud accomplishment in his life would be to get a constitutional amendment that bans abortion. The silence from the administration around women's health clinics is deafening over the last months. So what are they doing? Have you met with John Ashcroft, for example?
I know that the National Abortion Federation has called for a meeting with John Ashcroft, and I know that they are incredibly impressed with the cooperation of the FBI and that they've prioritized this event and transferred it to the domestic terrorism unit. However, I'm not aware of what the next step will be in making sure that they get a meeting with Mr. Ashcroft.
I understand that Planned Parenthood Federation of America has asked to meet with Ashcroft since he came into office, and he has refused.
We are an independent provider, independent of Planned Parenthood, and so I'm not aware of what happened with that meeting, and I'm not surprised that he refused. I think that this administration is, you know, handling the abortion issue with kid gloves at this point, because they do realize that they're not only dealing with international terrorism, but they're needing to acknowledge, again, domestic terrorism.
Can you explain who the Army of God is?
The Army of God is apparently an organization made up of individuals who have independently and as a group worked to threaten and actually harm abortion providers and their clinics. Some of the individuals that are supposed to be associated with the organization are well-known names among abortion providers, such as James Kopp, who is still in France and is under conviction for the murder of Dr. Slepian, Michael Bray, who was accused of bombing several clinics and the National Abortion Federation's office. Donald Spitz is a spokesperson and an advocate for justifiable homicide, or the murdering of clinic workers and physicians. They hold a dinner every year that is, its point is to extol the work of anti-choice terrorist activists and honor them for being in prison for acts of terrorism against providers. So they're a pretty scary lot. People definitely to be taken seriously, even though these letters, again, have all turned up negative for anthrax at this point. There were a couple initial preliminary field tests that proved positive, but they think that they were false positives. So these were anthrax hoaxes again, but the individuals associated with the Army of God are to be taken very seriously.
I was very struck speaking to a friend who works at Planned Parenthood in New York after the September 11th attacks, asking how she felt. She was just saying that all the precautions that people are taking now at the networks and other places where the anthrax threats were, that you all have been living under this threat for a very long time, that their stuff is put through x-rays, that they change their routes going home. They've often changed their home numbers. They are living with a kind of threat that Americans now know in the last month for the last years. And very little is known about this in the outside world, or is it covered very much?
Well, for more than 20 years, abortion clinics and the providers of those services have been targets of terrorism. Our physicians and clinic workers have been murdered by religious and political extremists, and our centers have been attacked with bombs and dangerous chemicals. And as you know, since 1998, hundreds at this point, reproductive health facilities have been receiving threatening letters claiming to contain anthrax and bombs. And one thing that we've learned is that the ultimate goal of terrorists is not necessarily to inflict physical harm, but to paralyze us, to inflict emotional damage, and to divert us from our normal routines. So we also know that while we need to take additional precautions, it's just as important to continue living with a sense of spirit and optimism. And we'd like to let people know that, you know, that this is what we've become good at, is trying to avoid a sense of isolation and fear and panic. And you need to be able to talk to your family, talk to your friends, talk to your loved ones about the feelings that you're having around fear, and check out assumptions and find support and solidarity in the people around you.
Kudrick McCullough, I want to thank you very much for being with us, abortion provider at the Feminist Health Center in New Hampshire. She opened a FedEx package on Thursday that contained an anthrax threat with the statement, "You're going to die." You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we're going to Doha, Qatar. The World Trade Organization meeting is taking place there, and there is protest there as well as around the world. And we'll end up on East Timor. Today is the 10th anniversary of the November 12th massacre of 1991, when the Indonesian military, using US M16s, gunned down more than 270 Timorese. We'll talk about state terror, and we'll have an extended program on this in our second hour. We'll be going to Dili, East Timor, and we'll be joined by a Timorese representative here in our Firehouse studio. Stay with us.
Now they take him, and they teach him, and they groom him for life, then they set him on a path where he's bound to get ill.
say who gonna take away his license to kill. Now he's helping for destruction. He's afraid and confused, and his brain has been mismanaged with great skill. Now all he believes are his eyes, and his eyes, they just tell him lies. But there's a woman on my block, sitting there in a cold chill. She said, who gonna take away his license?
License to Kill, Bob Dylan, here on the War and Peace Report. This is Democracy Now! in Exile, as we break the sound barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, today is the fourth day of the five-day meetings of the World Trade Organization, which are taking place in the tiny island Gulf state of Qatar. The United States and Switzerland edge closer to agreement with developing countries demanding more leeway to override drug patents for health emergencies, one of the issues threatening to block new global trade talks. The dispute has dominated the WTO conference, where ministers are hoping to launch a new round of negotiations to lower barriers to global commerce. Pressure's also building to reach a compromise on other hot issues like anti-dumping rules and agricultural subsidies. Rich countries hope to come away from the WTO ministerial meeting tomorrow with an agreement on launching new trade talks, which they argue would give the faltering world economy a much-needed confidence boost. Developing countries are demanding more market access for their textiles and agricultural products in recognition that some past pledges of help have yet to be fulfilled. Brazil and India, which have large generic drug industries, are leading the push for a declaration that patent rights won't block poor countries from responding to AIDS and other health crises. The United States and Switzerland are loath to alter the WTO's intellectual property agreement, worried about undermining their own drug industries. Poor countries that don't have manufacturing capability can override patents and import life-saving drugs, but the exporting countries could face trade sanctions. Doha, Qatar must have seemed like an ideal location when the World Trade Organization chose it a year ago to host this week's crucial gathering of trade ministers. At the time, the main security concern on the minds of WTO officials was the threat of a repeat of the large anti-globalization protests in a country which forbids public protest. Qatar seemed the place to have the next protest for the trade ministers. We're joined on the phone now by Thatcher Collins. He's a correspondent with Free Speech Radio News in Doha. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Hello.
It's good to have you with us. So tell us what's happened in the last hours.
Well, this afternoon there was supposed to be a press conference by a group of Caribbean delegates, and that's been postponed twice. And generally that means that negotiations are still hot and progressing. And some of the Caribbean countries, namely Jamaica, were threatening to vote against a new trade round. And what this means is that with the postponed agreements is that they may be going back on that, or they may be that people are trying to negotiate them away from that position. So that's going on right now. Also, the EU, which wants stronger environmental clarification, but no changes, has decided that they don't need specific clarifications at this point, only that it will be decided that somehow they will negotiate in the new round, and that's a change for them. But that's what's happened in the past couple hours.
And tell us what has happened over the weekend. What has been agreed upon by these trade ministers, and what kind of protest or dissent have they faced in Qatar?
Well, as one delegate said, nothing has been agreed upon until everything has been agreed upon, because no one will make a firm statement about what they've actually committed because they're posturing and they say one thing in order to try to get maybe something a little bit less. And so they won't. I don't think anything's been decided. However, it seems that the TRIPS agreement is going very well, and that was the thing that was worrying most of the delegates here. That's really all they've announced is that it's going well.
But explain what you mean by TRIPS agreement.
That's the trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights, and that regulates patent laws and like like software and music, and the patents on genetically engineered foods.
I understand that Vandana Shiva and José Bové held a news conference where they spoke, and I was wondering if you could play some of what they had to say for us.
Yes, but before I play that, I'll explain the background behind this, because it's rather interesting. Right now I'm in the NGO Center, which is a five-minute walk from the Sheraton Hotel where the conference is being held, and it's pretty isolated, and press rarely make it over here. There are meetings here all the time, and not well attended by the press at all. And when I attend, I'm frequently one of two journalists, if not the only journalist. And so what they've decided is that, well, they've come to the conclusion that they're marginalized over here, and have decided to bring their press conferences to the Sheraton Hotel itself. So as I was talking to you on Friday night, exactly that time was the beginning of the opening session, and they staged a surprise protest at that time and stood in front of the door as United States Trade Representative Robert Zolik was coming in, and they had their mouths taped with duct tape and were holding signs. And basically their idea, what they gave to the press, was that the WTO did not have a transparent process, and they were protesting against that. So they've taken that tactic, and they've done it every single day since. The day after, they also went to a press conference that was being given by Robert Zolik, and stood outside in front of the door and blocked the door, and he had to leave out through a back door. And at that point, they were talking about the process that delegates have to go through from the third world, and how they're marginalized, and how other economic policies are used to strong arm third world nations in the WTO consensus process. Then on the third day, there's a tent just outside of the press room in the conference center, and they've moved all of their press conferences to there, or the big ones anyway. And this is from that. It's about it's a protest about TRIPS, and it starts off with Vandana Shiva, who is from India and the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Natural Resource Policy. Then it's followed by José Bové, who's representing Via Campesina, and then Asia Russell from ACT OUT. And then Vandana Shiva comes in at the end of this clip.
And there are many groups here who have spent the last 10 years decoding what the trade-related intellectual property rights agreement is about. It's basically a treaty to create monopolies over all of life, to empower the corporations who have already created monopolies in seeds and in medicine to now have monopolies on genes, on genomes, and all living materials. There is, in this conference, a particular attempt to undo the work that developing countries have done over 2 years to correct the deficiencies and perversions of the TRIPS agreement. The developing countries have used their mandated right in the review of Article 27.3b and the review of the whole of TRIPS under Article 71.1 to basically stop the piracy of third world knowledge, as in the case of Basmati and Neem, and there's an epidemic, there are hundreds of cases we have. The patenting of seeds, which has become the reason for highest levels of indebtedness in the third world, because the seed corporations are now the biotechnology corporations, and they are also the chemical corporations. They sell the seeds that require more chemicals, and farmers are getting in deep into debt. And you heard the story of two farmers, but our organization has tracked the farmer suicides, and we have 20,000 farmers suicides in 3 years in India because of the policies of trade liberalization and seed monopolies. The second aspect, besides biopiracy, is related to the ethical issues of patenting life. And we have the biggest movements of the world, from farmers' movements, food security issues, ecological ethical movements, consumer movements, indigenous people's movements. We are very disturbed that the TRIPS debate is being transformed into a debate not of changing TRIPS and removing its deficiencies, but of upholding TRIPS and giving it a new lease of life. We want life integrity defended. We want the integrity of third world innovation recognized and defended, and biopiracy made illegal. TRIPS integrity has to be sacrificed because it's an integrity of piracy, it's an integrity of predation, it's an integrity of pushing people with epidemic, victims of epidemic diseases to death, but also farmers to death. And we want to bring the whole issue of the relationship of this treaty with treaties that have already been negotiated under the Convention on Biological Diversity, the Treaty for Plant Genetic Resources in the FAO, and the details of these treaties, our colleagues here will give you. But we do not want an erasure of the work of other treaties, centuries of innovation by farmers, 2 years of negotiations on the review of TRIPS by an empty declaration that says TRIPS above all. We want life above TRIPS.
Right.
That was Vandana Shiva, the well-known Indian anti-corporate globalization activist. This is José Bové.
Which is the union of farmers in the world. For all the farmers in the world, farmers from the developing countries, but also for the farmers from the developing countries.
French farmer.
GMOs and patent on life is going to kill all the possibility of the farmers to be able to have their own seeds, to be able to choose their own agriculture. For us, this is the principal fight. In this meeting in Doha, we're talking about TRIPS, and we are talking also about agriculture. But if we don't change TRIPS, it's no matter anymore to discuss about agriculture. So this is really the central point for all the farmers in the world. And this is why the farmers from Via Campesina decided all over the world to fight very strongly and to destroy all the crops we can find genetically modified crops. For us, this are actions to save the biodiversity of the humanity and the human rights.
That was José Bové.
And I'm from ACT UP Philadelphia and the Health Gap Coalition. We came to Doha because a central controversy at this ministerial is that poor countries are seeking an end to the grip exercised by multinational pharmaceutical companies and the wealthy governments that are restricting access to life-extending medicines and tools that promote public health in developing countries and in least developed countries. They have drawn a line in the sand demanding that nothing in the TRIPS agreement stand in the way of the public health. This is a modest proposal. This is a reasonable proposal, and we came to Doha because the obstructors demanding that the developing countries give in are the U.S. government, the Swiss government, and the delegation from Japan. We object to this. We say when intellectual property obstructs access to public health, access to essential drugs like AIDS drugs, malaria drugs, drugs for diabetes, drugs for cancer, patents must be broken. If no declaration can be come together by the end of Doha on TRIPS and public health, it will be the blame laid at the foot of the U.S. government, and this will pass into doubt the entire validity of the TRIPS agreement when it comes to patenting on essential medicine. And we say drug company greed kills, the greed of wealthy nations kills, and we demand access to affordable medications and access to public health tools for all people.
And the drug companies are the seed companies, are the biotech companies, and they kill through seed monopolies.
Vandana Shiva.
Genome monopolies, they kill through medicine monopolies.
Right.
We want the TRIPS debate in its full-fledged ethical implications, ecological implications, implications for food security, farmers' livelihoods, and the health rights of the people. All these on the table. They are the mandated review. We will not tolerate the brushing under the rug of these critical issues that have been raised by the peoples of the world. We will not let an empty document go out of Doha. We want to reclaim the right to life of all people and all farmers, including the right to accessible seed, the right to accessible food and affordable food, and the right to affordable medicine. Food,
seed and medicine, that is what we stand for, and monopolies that steal this from us will not be tolerated. Thank you.
Break the monopoly.
If you
And that ended with Vandana Shiva. And there are a few more points about these protests that I should mention, that this protest had a die-in street theater, and someone dressed up as Basmati Rice, and they had people pretending to be dead farmers. The day before, they had a mock WTO meeting in the process, and during that the protest yesterday, there was a press conference next door, and no one attended that conference, instead came to this one. And so the European Union Commission members who were giving that press conference came outside to the protest, and when it was over, one of the members stood up on a chair and begged people to come over to his press conference. Essentially, they stole the show, and it was obvious. And I went into his press conference, and at that point, he openly asked for people to comment and critique their policy, which he hadn't done the day before at the same press conference. And as for media coverage, this has been getting extensive coverage in the third world press, but not in the first world or developed nations press. It was on Al Jazeera, for instance, but it wasn't on BBC.
Well, Thatcher Collins, I want to thank you very much for being with us, correspondent with Free Speech Radio News in Doha, Qatar. Again, the people we just heard, among them José Bové, French farmer and unionist. He is the man who led other farmers just before the Seattle protests in his home community of southern France, when the United States imposed sanctions against France for not allowing hormone-injected beef into the country. And those sanctions included raising tariffs on Roquefort cheese, the only area in the world where it's made, is José Bové's area. He said it would wipe out the whole regional economy there. And so in protest, he and other farmers went to the local McDonald's that was just being built, and they dismantled the golden arches, bringing them to the local prefecture, leaving them on the front yard, went home, were put in jail. And as they sat in jail, they became national heroes in France. Now José Bové in Doha, Qatar, with Vandana Shiva, the Indian anti-corporate globalization activist Asia Russell of ACT UP, and about 50 other leaders of the anti-globalization movement who were granted permission to attend meetings in Qatar, while thousands of others were kept out. But that hasn't stopped them from protesting, as people are involved with protests and other kinds of actions around the country around the issue of the WTO. On Friday, several hundred activists in New York marched in Midtown Manhattan, visiting the offices of several corporations like Citibank on a corporate tour of shame. And in California, it was a day of Another World is Paintable. And among those who were active in it was David Solnit with Action for Local Global Justice. And he's on the line with us right now. What did you do around the World Trade Organization, David Solnit?
We had 3 days of action on Thursday the 8th, the day before. Five affinity groups fanned out through the Bay Area and dropped banners over Bay Area highways during rush hour to let everybody know about the following actions, and also because the issues had been largely blacked out in the mainstream media, to let people know that the WTO was meeting the following day and going to try and push forward what we had stopped them from doing in Seattle. So that was on Thursday. On Friday, we held a march and festival in San Francisco with about 700 people marching on Pacific Gas and Electric Company. And we've been focusing on the local impacts of our local communities of corporate globalization. So here we are focusing on Midway Village and Bayview Hunters Point, fighting a toxic waste site that their houses were built on, and then respectively a toxic power plant. And we took over the front area in front of PG&E, occupied the entire street, and proceeded to turn it into a giant mural against both the WTO and PG&E's impact on those communities.
Explain the concept of Another World is Paintable.
Leading up to the actions, we did a mobile mural project called Another World is Paintable. And we went to communities throughout the Bay Area, to schools, and we asked people to graphically paint their vision of alternatives to corporate globalization, alternatives to the problems in their communities, and came out with a bunch of very beautiful, compelling, and motivating images of the kinds of lives and worlds people would like to live in that are very different than the one we live in now.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, Henry Clark will be joining us from West County Toxics Coalition in the Bay Area as well. And then we'll go to Seattle to find out about what WTO protests look like there, almost 2 years after the major battle of Seattle. And finally, we're going to end with East Timor. We'll spend the second hour on that issue. And we just got this news just in. An American Airlines 767 has crashed in the Queens Borough of New York City. Port Authority officials say the plane was bound for JFK Airport. Thick black smoke is billowing over the area, and local media are reporting several houses on fire. We'll bring you more on that story after the break. Stay with us. Jimmy Cliff, we all are one. I'm Amy Goodman here on the War and Peace Report. Again, the latest news just came over the wire. American Airlines 767 has crashed in the Queens Borough of New York. Port Authority officials are saying that the plane was setting to land at JFK Airport. Thick black smoke billowing over the area. We'll continue to bring you more on that. Henry Clark with the West County Toxics Coalition, can you give us the latest on how you're connecting local issues to international issues?
Yes. Here in Richmond, West County Toxics Coalition was part of a broad coalition that sponsored a big march to say no to the World Trade Organization and to globalize justice, not war and toxic pollution. We focused on the Chevron refinery here in the Richmond community. That's had been a long-standing problem to the community from their polluting activities that have caused a wide variety of health-related problems in our community here. Chevron pretends to want to be a good neighbor to us in Richmond, yet when we consult with their friends and allies in other parts of the world who were also represented at a demonstration, for instance, people in Nigeria who was also addressing problems from Chevron operations in Nigeria, as well as friends from Ecuador that are dealing with the joint Chevron and Texaco operations that were left over there that contaminated the environment. So our protests had an international flavor to it, and we basically wanted to educate people in our community about the World Trade Organization and its policies and how it would affect us locally, not only in regard to Chevron and energy issues, but also the possibilities of privatizing local services, which Richmond now is in the midst of a controversy already, where there's a firm based in Paris, France, that's trying to take charge of the city's wastewater treatment plant, and residents are organizing against that. So we have good sense of how the World Trade Organization policies can affect us locally. And we had a major spirited demonstration with about 1,200 high-spirited marches from all over the Bay Area that marched to the Chevron refinery for international festive program.
We're also joined on the telephone by Emily Riley with the World Trade Organization protest in Seattle. Again, the latest news we have as we're going back and forth between two stories, a major plane crash in Queens, New York. There was a plane that was just about to land at Kennedy Airport, American Airlines 767. It's crashed into Queens. At least four houses are now on fire, and we're going to continue to bring you that story. JFK, Newark, and LaGuardia have been closed. The crash happened about 30 minutes before I'm broadcasting this now. Again, it was on its way to land in JFK. JFK, Newark, LaGuardia airports all closed at this point. Emily Riley, just 30 seconds, what you were doing in Seattle.
We had a protest that we had a Somali grocery store that was raided on Wednesday by local and federal police. And the Somali community had a demonstration at INS, and we rerouted our march. We were originally going to tie in the prison industrial complex with the WTO, but we rerouted our march to be in solidarity with the Somali community, and had an incredibly beautiful day where we came together with them and connected what's happening right now in terms of the war on terrorism and corporate globalization.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Emily. I understand that some Somali businesses were in trouble in Seattle, and you expressed solidarity with them.
Yes. There was a small grocery store, and part of it was a travel agency and a money transfer service, and apparently they were accused of laundering money to bin Laden. And everything was taken out of the grocery store, including the refrigerating systems and the shelves, and they were holding a picket line, and a few of us happened. And, hello?
We're here.
Okay. And a few of us happened to go down there and be on the picket line and decided to connect everything that was going on, and it was really wonderful.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. We are cutting this short as we are trying to bring people also the latest news that is happening here in New York. A plane crashed. It looks like at about, looking at the clock here, around 9:15 on its way to land in JFK. It was an American Airlines 767, crashed into houses. At least four houses are on fire. Now JFK, Newark, LaGuardia have been closed. The crash happened about 30 minutes ago. We're going to play you a clip now on this 10th anniversary of the Indonesian massacre of Timorese, November 12th, 1991, of what happened on that day. And when we come back, we'll get more information on the plane crash. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. This comes from a documentary that I did with Alan Nairn, a journalist, after the massacre of Santa Cruz.
Journalist Alan Nairn and I returned to East Timor last fall in order to be present for a historic event. A special delegation from the United Nations and Portugal was due to visit East Timor. The Timorese hoped the visit would finally lead to UN action and enforcement of the Security Council resolutions calling on Indonesia to withdraw from East Timor.
We were told in place after place that the army had been holding neighborhood and village meetings to warn the Timorese that if they tried to speak to the UN Portuguese delegation, they and their families would be killed. And Bishop Bello, the Bishop of East Timor, told us that the threat was, we will kill your family to the seventh generation.
But despite the threats and a dramatic increase in disappearances, torture, and deaths, Timorese had prepared to speak out. They had met in secret, making banners and petitions for the delegation. When the army tried to hunt them down, many had gone into hiding and sought refuge inside churches. But under pressure from the United States, the visit of the delegation had been called off. 3 days later, with the world spotlight removed, the army stormed the Motayal, Dili's main Catholic church, and killed a young man named Sebastião Gomes, who had taken refuge there. And then came the morning of November 12th, the two-week commemoration of Sebastião's funeral. A memorial mass and procession were planned to lay flowers on Sebastião's grave. After the mass was held at the Motayal, People, young and old, came out into the street, and in a land where public speech and assembly had been forbidden for over a decade, they started chanting. The Timorese then held up banners drawn on bedsheets. They had been prepared for the delegation that never came. The banners called on Indonesia to leave East Timor and said things like, "Why the Indonesian army shoot our church?" The Timorese were facing a gauntlet of troops that stretched the length of Dili. It was the boldest act of public protest occupied Timor had ever seen.
More and more Timorese joined the procession. They came from huts and schools and offices along the way. And there was this building feeling of exhilaration as well as fear among the Timorese. And when they reached the cemetery, the crowd had swelled to maybe 5,000 people. Some went inside to lay flowers on Sebastiao's grave. Most of the crowd was still outside. And then suddenly someone looked up, and we saw that marching up along the same route that the Timorese had come, came a long column of Indonesian troops, dressed in brown, holding M16s in front of them, marching in a very slow, deliberate fashion, hundreds and hundreds of troops coming straight at the Timorese.
Alan suggested we walk to the front of the crowd between the soldiers and the Timorese, because although we knew that the army had committed many massacres, we hoped that we, as foreign journalists, could serve as a shield for the Timorese. Standing with headphones on and microphone and camera out in full view, we went and stood in the middle of the road, looking straight at the approaching troops. Behind us, the crowd was hushed as some Timorese tried to turn away, but they were hemmed in by cemetery walls.
The soldiers marched straight up to us. They never broke their stride. We were enveloped by the troops, and when they got a few yards past us, within a dozen yards of the Timorese, they raised their rifles to their shoulders all at once, and they opened fire. The Timorese, in an instant, were down. It was torn apart by the bullets. The street was covered with bodies, covered with blood, and the soldiers just kept on coming. They poured in, one rank after another. They leaped over the bodies of those who were down. They were aiming and shooting people in the back. I could see their limbs being torn, their bodies exploding. There was blood spurting out into the air, the pop of the bullets everywhere. And it was very organized, very systematic. The soldiers did not stop. They just kept on shooting until no one was left standing.
A group of soldiers grabbed my microphone and threw me to the ground, kicking and punching me. At that point, Alan threw himself on top of me, protecting me from further injury. The soldiers then used their rifle butts like baseball bats, beating Alan until they fractured his skull. As we sat on the ground, Alan covered in blood, a group of soldiers lined up and pointed their M16s at our heads. They had stripped us of all of our equipment. We just kept shouting, "We're from America." In the end, they decided not to execute us.
The soldiers beat us, but we actually had received privileged treatment. We were still alive. They kept on firing into the Timorese. We were able to get onto a passing civilian truck, went into hiding, but the Timorese who had been with us there on the cemetery road, most of them were dead.
Inside the cemetery walls, Max Stahl, a filmmaker on assignment with Yorkshire TV, had his video camera running.
The soldiers began at that point to encircle the entire cemetery. I saw soldiers as they gradually moved towards the middle, picking out people who were wounded or taking refuge between the tombstones. And when they got to them, they beat them and assembled them in the back of the cemetery. People were stripped to their waist. They had their thumbs tied behind their backs. And they were made to look at the ground. And if they looked up, they were immediately beaten, usually with a rifle butt.
Max Stahl was filming near a crypt in the middle of the cemetery. Some of the wounded and those too scared to run were huddled inside praying. As Stahl filmed, he buried his video cassettes in a fresh grave. Then he was arrested by the troops.
Whilst I was being interrogated, I observed these trucks driving by with more people in them. These people were clearly in a kind of paralysis.
You've been listening to the massacre of East Timor that happened 10 years ago today. That from the documentary Massacre, the story of East Timor, I produced with Alan Nearon. More than 270 Timorese died. I'm having the strangest experience now of listening to this and then also listening on radio and television to the latest news that we have just heard, and that is that a plane has gone down in Queens. It just had left Kennedy Airport. It was headed to Santo Domingo. It is not a 767, as we reported earlier. It's an American Airlines Flight 587. It looks like an Airbus 300. It crashed into the Rockaways in Queens. It's not clear why it happened. All three airports have now been closed in New York, LaGuardia, Kennedy, as well as Newark. And I was just listening to the mayor speaking on the radio. In our last minutes, we're joined by Joe Nevins, who is on the telephone, who has written a piece that talks about the two ground zeros. Maybe eerily, we don't know what is happening right now with this plane, but Joe Nevins, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What has happened now with this American Airlines flight, but you talk about two ground zeros, World Trade Center. Well, we've got Afghanistan, and then you talk about East Timor in this last minute before we go to our new hour.
That's right. In September 1999, many international observers described Dili, East Timor as ground zero as well. In the aftermath of a United Nations-sponsored referendum that took place there by which the people of East Timor, after almost 24 years of a brutal military occupation, were able to decide their political fate, the Indonesian military went on a rampage, unleashing a campaign of terror and destruction. In the immediate aftermath, they destroyed about 70% of East Timor's buildings and infrastructure, forcibly deported about a third of the population to Indonesia, where tens of thousands of them still remain, and raped untold numbers of women. In addition to massacring what is conservatively estimated to be about 2,000, but most likely the figure is much higher. As I said, many people call this ground zero. Now, the difference is in New York, ground zero was created over about 20 minutes. In East Timor, it took place over about 3 or 4 weeks in the full view, for the most part, of the international community. And it wasn't until September 11th, 1999, exactly 2 years prior to the terror in New York City.
We have 10 seconds.
That the Clinton administration cut off its weaponry. So that's the big difference, is where the big players in the international community were involved in the making of Ground Zero in East Timor. Now they're on the other side. But the reactions are very different.
Well, we're going to take this on in our next hour. We're also going to take on the latest news. Again, plane crash in New York City. A plane that was headed away from Kennedy Airport had just taken off, headed to Santo Domingo. An A300 Airbus looks like it went down in the Rockaways. Not clear what happened, if there was an explosion on board or what. It has crashed into a number of houses. There is a major fire in the Rockaways, and we don't know how many people were on board. It was American Airlines Flight 587. We'll bring you the latest as we continue today. That does it for the program. Program produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, Anthony Sloan, our engineer and music maestro. You can reach us by email at mail@democracynow.org. In our next hour, we're going to look at this 10th anniversary of the massacre of Timor, and we'll bring you the latest news on the plane crash. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. A plane has crashed in the Rockaways in Queens, New York. It is not clear at this point what the cause is. It was American Airlines Flight 587. It had just taken off and was headed to Santo Domingo. It has created a major fire on the ground. We don't know how many casualties have occurred as of yet. And today is the 10th anniversary of the massacre of East Timor. Me. Oh.
lost one sister and two brothers.
It was 10 days before I was to give birth. The army was shooting people, and they would die at our feet, but we couldn't stop to help them.
I know families that were totally wiped out.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We have this news just in: major plane crash in New York. American Airlines Flight 587 that was taking off from Kennedy Airport on its way to Santo Domingo, an Airbus A300, has crashed in Queens. It is not clear what the cause. There was a major fire on board. It is not clear if it came from an explosion on board. The plane crashed into the Rockaways. A number of homes are on fire. Unclear how many people were on the plane. All three airports in the New York area, LaGuardia, Kennedy, and Newark airports, have been closed, and we'll continue to update you on this story as we learn about it. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, opposition forces claiming to have the ruling Taliban on the run pressed their drive in northeastern Afghanistan this weekend. The opposition Northern Alliance, backed by intense U.S. bombing and logistical support from British and U.S. special forces on the ground, has moved steadily across northern Afghanistan since occupying the strategic city of Mazar-e-Sharif on Friday. As they appear to cement their control of northern cities, Northern Alliance commanders have discussed a possible offensive against the capital city of Kabul. This as U.S. bombers continue to carpet bomb Taliban positions north of the city. U.S. officials have told the alliance to stay out of the capital while they pursue discussions with alliance officials as well as Pakistan and other neighboring countries on what kind of administration to install there. But officials of the Northern Alliance have rejected arguments that they're unwelcome in Kabul, which was taken by the Taliban in 1996 after fighting among Northern Alliance warlords reduced the city to rubble and killed tens of thousands of civilians. A vote-by-vote review of untallied ballots in the 2000 Florida presidential election indicates that George W. Bush would have lost Florida and therefore the presidency had Al Gore pursued and gained a complete statewide recount. The new data, compiled by the Associated Press and seven other news organizations, suggests that Gore followed a legal strategy after Election Day that would have led to defeat even if the U.S. Supreme Court had not intervened to effectively give the state to Bush. Gore sought a recount of a relatively small portion of the state's disputed ballots, while the review indicates his only chance lay in a course he advocated publicly but did not pursue in court, a full statewide recount of all Florida's untallied votes. The media consortium hired the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago to view each untallied ballot and gather information about how it was marked. The consortium used computers to sort and tabulate votes based on varying scenarios that had been raised during the post-election scramble in Florida. Completing two partial recounts that Gore unsuccessfully pursued in court showed Bush maintaining a lead ranging from 225 to 493 votes, meaning Bush still would have won if the U.S. Supreme Court had allowed a partial statewide recount to continue. But under any standard that tabulated all disputed votes statewide, Gore erased Bush's advantage and emerged with a tiny lead that ranged from 42 to 171 votes. The media consortium found that Gore outpolled Bush under six scenarios for counting all undervotes and overvotes statewide. The consortium delayed releasing the results of the study for over a month as the Bush administration declared war on Afghanistan. And right now, the latest news that we have coming out of the airplane crash, it looks like 44 fire trucks have been deployed to the Rockaways. 200 firefighters have been dispatched on board the American Airlines flight that took off from Kennedy Airport and was headed to Santo Domingo, where 246 passengers and 9 crew members. At this point, all 3 major airports in the New York City area, Newark, LaGuardia, and Kennedy, have been closed. Again, this was Flight 587, American Airlines flight to Santo Domingo, and it went down in the Rockaways in Queens. Not clear at this point what has caused this explosion, and we'll give you the latest as we learn it. The Washington Post is reporting that the American Red Cross collected hundreds of thousands of blood donations after September 11th, knowing that the blood could not be used for victims of the terrorist attacks. After selling some of the surplus blood to hospitals, the Red Cross has begun to destroy thousands of pints that have outlasted their shelf life. Directors of several Red Cross blood centers said their sites may discard as many as 1 of every 5 donations, and the national total could easily reach tens of thousands. Although the Red Cross told the public that surplus blood would be frozen, it did not have the resources to freeze large amounts of excess blood. And President Bush spoke to the United Nations this weekend, once again warning world leaders that they are either with the U.S. or they are with the terrorists. While everyone who spoke at the UN meeting condemned the September 11th attacks, many world leaders also expressed their opposition to the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan. Saudi Arabia's Prince Faisal also slammed the Bush administration for its backing of Israel and Bush's equation of Palestinian resistance to Israeli occupation as terrorism, saying it's enough to make a sane man go mad. And South African President Thabo Mbeki said it was obvious that the fundamental conflict in the world today is the deprivation of millions coexisting side by side with islands of enormous wealth and prosperity. And the latest news from here in New York, where we are broadcasting from, there has been a level 1 alert declared for all of New York City. Fire trucks can be heard being dispatched from downtown Manhattan. We're hearing them go by here at the firehouse. We are not functioning as a firehouse now. We are in Engine Company 31 in Chinatown. It used to be a firehouse. It is just blocks from what was the first Ground Zero, and that was where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. Again, 44 fire trucks, 200 firefighters have been dispatched. All tunnels have been closed into New York City, and the major airports have been closed as a result of this. American Airlines flight 587 that has gone down in the Rockaways. Again, the number of people on board, more than 250. Stay with us. Edwin Starr singing War here on the War and Peace Report, the exception to the rulers. This is Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. We have a prepared show for you going back 10 years to the massacre at Santa Cruz in East Timor, where more than 270 Timorese were killed. And we're also dealing with late-breaking news that happened as we were broadcasting. CNN is confirming that the plane, the American Airlines jet that crashed today in the New York City borough of Queens, is American Airlines Flight 587 from New York, John F. Kennedy International Airport, to Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic. The plane was an Airbus A300. American Airlines did not immediately release the number of passengers on the flight. Smoke is extremely thick in the borough of Queens. There are two crash sites, one where the plane hit the ground and another where the engine, which was on fire, also hit. Hundreds of firefighters have been dispatched to the area. We actually hear fire trucks going by here. A New York police spokesman said the plane crashed in the Rockaways, at least four houses on fire. A huge plume of smoke can be seen rising from the site. All three New York City area airports, Kennedy, LaGuardia, and Newark, have been closed after the crash. Rudolph Giuliani, the mayor of New York, is declaring a level one emergency, mobilizing all available police, fire, and emergency personnel. Again, we do not know the cause of this crash. It was a report that there was a fire on board. The plane went down in the Rockaways. There was, at latest count, 246 passengers reported on board, 9 crew members on that flight. All tunnels into New York and the major airports in New York are closed, a level one alert for this city. And today we are talking about the issue of terrorism. Again, we don't know what has happened with this flight, what caused it, but we thought we'd go back in history, something the media doesn't do very well, and look at one story, a place that has also been called Ground Zero. The UN Security Council last week formally endorsed East Timor's plans to declare independence on May 20th of next year, pledging that the United Nations will remain engaged in the world's newest nation. East Timor's Constituent Assembly is writing the country's constitution and preparing for the day they will run their own affairs. In Dili, residents are holding a ceremony, as they do every November 12th, to commemorate the Santa Cruz massacre. 10 years ago today, Indonesian troops massacred at least 270 East Timorese in the Santa Cruz Cemetery in Dili, East Timor, as they engaged in a memorial service and a protest to honor another young man, Sebastio Gomez, who had been slain by the Indonesian military. The Indonesian troops who committed the massacre used U.S. M-16s provided by the U.S. The Indonesian military had been trained, armed, and financed by the U.S. We are joined on the telephone now by Matthew Jardine, who's written a very interesting piece comparing Ground Zeroes, Ground Zero East Timor, Ground Zero United States, just blocks from here. Matthew Jardine, as we're getting this latest news and trying to make sense of that and trying to bring our listeners the latest, can you go back and tell us what your comparison is about?
When the commentators began describing the World Trade Center in New York as Ground Zero, it immediately made me think of the last time I heard that term, which was in September 1999 in the aftermath of East Timor's vote for independence. When it became known that the people of East Timor had voted overwhelmingly in favor of independence, in favor of ending the Indonesian occupation, the Indonesian military and its militia proxies, or paramilitary proxies, began to launch a campaign of terror and destruction. In over a 3 to 4 week period, the Indonesian military destroyed about 70% of the country's buildings and infrastructure, deported about a third of the population to Indonesia forcibly. It's about 250,000 people. And by the way, tens of thousands of East Timorese remain forcibly held in Indonesia. And they raped untold numbers of women, in addition to massacring what is conservatively estimated to be 2,000 people. And when the international community returned to East Timor after being forced out by the Indonesian military, commentators began immediately to refer to East Timor as Ground Zero. Right? Now, the difference is between the Ground Zero in New York and the Ground Zero in East Timor is the one in New York took place over about a 20-minute period in terms of its making. And again, in East Timor, it took place over 3 to 4 weeks. And the other big difference is that the United States, of course, has tremendous financial resources to help recover from the devastation at Ground Zero, whereas East Timor, already one of the poorest places in the world prior to what took place in their country in September 1999, has very little to rebuild and recover from the devastation.
We're also joined on the telephone by Bella Gayos, who is an East Timorese student activist who sought asylum in Canada, returned to East Timor with Canadian troops in 1999, now works for UN Radio in Dili, where she hosts a radio program on women's issues. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Bella Gayos.
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. Can you tell us what happened today in Dili, East Timor, in remembrance of the massacre of 10 years ago?
The day everybody in East Timor commemorated the 10 years of Dili massacre. It's quite a momentous day for everybody in this country, where people could easily go gather, have a big mass with no disturbance. And then the events was still taking place until even late, about 2 hours ago. Right now it's almost 12 o'clock. People, the whole country, actually Dili particularly, all the road was filled with candlelight just to remember those who have died 10 years ago.
Constancio Pinto is with us in the Firehouse studio, a former East Timorese resistance leader. Now, as East Timor moves to independence, he is a representative of the National Council of Timorese Resistance in Washington. It's great to have you with us, Constancio. I met Constancio 10 years ago, actually, in East Timor when you were working with the underground, with the resistance. And you were one of the major organizers of the November 12th procession that ultimately was fired upon by the Indonesian military. You were in hiding at that time. We met you the night before the massacre as you were getting word out to people, to international people like us. I was there with journalist Alan Nairn to let people know that this procession would take place. What are your thoughts today, 10 years later, in this age when the issue of terrorism is on everybody's mind?
Well, November 12th cannot be forgotten. You know, we have to remember it and all the time. And 2 days ago, I went back to my VCR and watched the movie, The Death of a Nation, to remember exactly what's happened in Santa Cruz Cemetery, and I found out that some of the people who we thought that they were killed were still survived, and that one of them is now in Lisbon. I wish he could be here also to talk about his experience during that drastic moment. I think for me, the reason why we are here today, we are almost got our full independence from UN is because of the Santa Cruz massacre. Santa Cruz massacre basically was the end of Indonesian occupation of East Timor, and I think because of that we got a lot of international community support all over the world, and which resulted in pressure on Indonesia to leave East Timor.
We're going to go back to that day by the tape recordings of that day. And the documentary did Massacre, the Story of East Timor. And we are also going to get the latest on what has happened in the plane crash. We, again, still have no word on the cause of this crash. There are reports that an engine was on fire. There was an explosion before the plane went down. This was an American Airlines flight that on this day, November 12th, had taken off from Kennedy. It was an Airbus A300 headed to the Dominican Republic with more than 250 people believed to be on board. There's a level one alert now in New York City The plane has gone down in the Rockaways in Queens, causing a major fire on the ground and another major fire on the ground caused by the falling out of the engine. We're going to continue to follow both stories and talk about the issue of terrorism and why people feel the way they do around the world and what people are dealing with here at home. Stay with us. Listening to the War and Peace Report. This music, Constancia, how do you pronounce it?
Hanan Korean.
And what is it?
It's an East Timorese song.
And today is the 10th anniversary of the massacre of East Timor, in which Indonesian troops, armed, financed, and trained by the U.S. military, gunned down more than 250 Timorese, one of the smaller massacres in Timor. More than a third of the population was killed in East Timor. As we talk about issues of terror and state terrorism, we are broadcasting from a firehouse blocks from Ground Zero. Right now outside, we're hearing planes go overhead. We're hearing fire trucks pass by. And we are bringing you the latest news we have on a plane that went down as it took off of Kennedy Airport on its way to the Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic. More than 250 people on board. New York City is on a level one alert at this point, although the Pentagon is saying that there is no connection to terrorism as of now with this American Airlines Flight 587 that has gone down in the Rockaways. The latest news we have, there are two crash sites, one where the plane went down, a major fire, and one where the engine fell off the plane. There are military jets flying over the area. At least 12 buildings are burning in the Rockaways. Apparently, the plane, the American Airlines flight, lost radio communications shortly after takeoff, and it looked like it was trying to circle around to come back to JFK. No word yet on the number of casualties. What those commentators are talking about now is an engine fell off the plane, and it fell separately from the jetliner. And at this point, as the plane has gone down and crashed in Queens and the Rockaways, there are all three airports, LaGuardia, Newark, and Kennedy, have been shut. The George Washington Bridge has been closed to traffic, and all major tunnels coming into the city have been closed. So that's the latest news we have here on the ground. We're going to continue with our program as we look back and talk about terror and state terror 10 years ago and today. We're joined on the phone from Dili by Bella Gayos. She is an East Timorese activist who has a radio program on women's issues. Bella, can you describe where you were 10 years ago today?
The flashback, the memory at the time was quite a national feeling. today the feeling is a bit different. I guess people understand more why we fight so hard, you know, why young people like myself and the young generation was so brave to stood up for their rights and fighting this invasion and occupation of Indonesia in our country. And I guess there was an open-minded to the world, to the international community, to really see what's going on in East Timor. And all this have make it clear now that what we are still trying to here in East Timor, we're still trying very hard to working with the development and reconstruction of our country. The result of what the world has never believed us for the last 24 years. So I hope that it's going to be a big lesson. And really, once again, would like to emphasize that this kind of a mistake will never, hopefully it never happen again and never be repeated.
We're going to go to the sounds of the massacre, to what happened on that day 10 years ago. Just a clip from the documentary Alan Aaron and I did a year after the massacre, having come back from East Timor, called Massacre, the Story of East Timor.
Journalist Alan Aaron and I returned to East Timor last fall in order to be present for a historic event. A special delegation from the United Nations and Portugal was due to visit East Timor. The Timorese hoped the visit would finally lead to UN action and enforcement of the Security Council resolutions calling on Indonesia to withdraw from East Timor.
We were told in place after place that the army had been holding neighborhood and village meetings to warn the Timorese that if they tried to speak to the UN Portuguese delegation, they and their families would be killed. And Bishop Bello, the Bishop of East Timor, told us that the threat was, we will kill your family to the seventh generation.
But despite the threats and a dramatic increase in disappearances, torture, and deaths, Timorese had prepared to speak out. They had met in secret, making banners and petitions for the delegation. When the army tried to hunt them down, many had gone into hiding and sought refuge inside churches. But under pressure from the United States, the visit of the delegation had been called off. 3 days later, with the world spotlight removed, the army stormed the Motayal, Dili's main Catholic church, and killed a young man named Sebastio Gomez, who had taken refuge there. And then came the morning of November 12th, the two-week commemoration of Sebastio's funeral. A memorial mass and procession were planned to lay flowers on Sebastio's grave. After the mass was held at the Motayal, people, young and old, came out into the street, and in a land where public speech and assembly had been forbidden for over a decade, they started chanting. The Timorese then held up banners drawn on bedsheets. They had been prepared for the delegation that never came. The banners called on Indonesia to leave East Timor and said things like, why the Indonesian army shoot our church? The Timorese were facing a gauntlet of troops that stretched the length of Dili. It was the boldest act of public protest occupied Timor had ever seen.
More and more Timorese joined the procession. They came from huts and schools and offices along the way. And there was this building feeling of exhilaration as well as fear among the Timorese. And when they reached the cemetery, the crowd had swelled to maybe 5,000 people. Some went inside to lay flowers on Sebastião's grave. Most of the crowd was still outside. And then suddenly someone looked up, and we saw that marching up along the same route that the Timorese had come, came a long column of Indonesian troops, dressed in brown, holding M16s in front of them, marching in a very slow, deliberate fashion, hundreds and hundreds of troops coming straight at the Timorese.
Alan suggested we walk to the front of the crowd between the soldiers and the Timorese, because although we knew that the army had committed many massacres, we hoped that we as foreign journalists could serve as a shield for the Timorese. Standing with headphones on and microphone and camera out in full view, we went and stood in the middle of the road, looking straight at the approaching troops. Behind us, the crowd was hushed as some Timorese tried to turn away, but they were hemmed in by cemetery walls.
The soldiers marched straight up to us. They never broke their stride. We were enveloped by the troops, and when they got a few yards past us, within a dozen yards of the Timorese, they raised their rifles to their shoulders all at once, and they opened fire. Timorese, in an instant, were down. It was torn apart by the bullets. The street was covered with bodies, covered with blood. and the soldiers just kept on coming. They poured in one rank after another. They leaped over the bodies of those who were down. They were aiming and shooting people in the back. I could see their limbs being torn, their bodies exploding. There was blood spurting out into the air, the pop of the bullets everywhere. And it was very organized, very systematic. The soldiers did not stop. They just kept on shooting until no one was left standing.
A group of soldiers grabbed my microphone and threw me to the ground, kicking and punching me. At that point, Alan threw himself on top of me, protecting me from further injury. The soldiers then used their rifle butts like baseball bats, beating Alan until they fractured his skull. As we sat on the ground, Alan covered in blood, a group of soldiers lined up and pointed their M16s at our heads. They had stripped us of all of our equipment. We just kept shouting, "We're from America." In the end, they decided not to execute us.
The soldiers beat us, but we actually had received privileged treatment. We were still alive. They kept on firing into the Timorese. We were able to get onto a passing civilian truck, went into hiding, but the Timorese who had been with us there on the cemetery road, most of them were dead.
Inside the cemetery walls, Max Stahl, a filmmaker on assignment with Yorkshire TV, had had his video camera running.
The soldiers began at that point to encircle the entire cemetery. I saw soldiers as they gradually moved towards the middle, picking out people who were wounded or taking refuge between the tombstones. And when they got to them, they beat them and assembled them in the back of the cemetery. People were stripped to their waist. They had their thumbs tied behind their backs. And they were made to look at the ground. And if they looked up, they were immediately beaten, usually with a rifle butt.
Max Stahl was filming near a crypt in the middle of the cemetery. Some of the wounded and those too scared to run were huddled inside praying. As Stahl filmed, he buried his video cassettes in a fresh grave. Then he was arrested by the troops.
Whilst I was being interrogated, I observed these trucks driving by with more people in them. These people were clearly in a kind of paralysis of fear. They were not able to move, some of them, at least in the cemetery, and indeed even in the trucks, when I saw them going by, were barely breathing. When people are that terrified, it's quite often difficult to tell if they're dead or alive.
After 9 hours in custody, Stahl went back to the cemetery under cover of night, dug up his video cassettes, and had them smuggled out of the country. Alan Nairn and I had managed to leave East Timor a few hours after the massacre. From a hospital on Guam, we reported what had happened to dozens of newspapers, radio, and television outlets around the world.
From Washington, this is the Pacifica Report for Tuesday, November 12, 1991. A massacre in East Timor. Among those injured were two journalists, including the news editor of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York.
They beat me and dragged me over and started slamming me with rifle butts and kicks and punches. And then Alan jumped on top of me, and they beat him very badly. But that was the least of what they did. They opened fire on the people, and these were truly...
日本政府はインドネシアに真相究明を申し入れ
when Indonesian troops opened fire on a crowd...
This is CBC Radio.
The massacre of 100 unarmed Timorese by the Indonesian military...
Photographs of a bloody massacre during a fight for freedom.
A portion of Massacre, the Story of East Timor, about the massacre that occurred 10 years ago today, November 12, 1991. We're joined in the studio by a guest from Dili, East Timor, Belagayos, Joe Nevins, on the line with us from California, and Constancio Pinto, one of the leaders of the Timorese Underground at that time, now a leader, representative of the Timorese government in Washington, D.C. Constancio, as we listen to what took place on that one day, more than 270 Timorese killed on that day by an army, the Indonesian army, using U.S. weapons. The Indonesian occupation of Timor lasted almost 25 years, begun under Suharto, one of the longest reigning dictators in the world. When we talk about issues of terror and what has happened to the people of Timor, your people, a third of the population, What about, for example, a war crimes tribunal? Where is East Timor on that issue?
Well, we keep pushing for a war criminal tribunal for East Timor. And as you know, at this moment, we have a serious crime section which is set up by the UNTAET. It is now trying
UNTAET
to...
being UNTAET being the United,
United Nations. Administration, civil administration for East Timor. So we brought a number of people to try, especially in East Timorese people who involved in the in serious crime 1999 mayhem. But also, it seems to me that we will extend this to Indonesian generals who were responsible for the massacres in 1991 and also 1999. So, but it is very difficult to go about because it all depends on also the cooperation of the Indonesian government with the international community.
What about the U.S. officials that supported the Indonesian military? I mean, going back to when Ford and Kissinger gave the go-ahead for the invasion of Timor, and then even when State Department officials under Kissinger wrote to him that the invasion in 75 was extremely bloody, that Congress would probably cut off aid to Indonesia, he told them to be quiet and said, we must not kick our ally in the teeth and not to leave a paper trail. Do you believe that they should be brought before a war crimes tribunal?
Well, there's no question about the U.S. involvement in the invasion of East Timor. Kissinger and President Ford both were in Indonesia in 1975, hours before the Indonesian invasion of East Timor. But talking about bringing the U.S. to the international to war criminal tribunal, well, this is not. I think we don't have any power to do this. We means the East Timorese. And because of that, Sinanak Guzman also often said that it is in the hands of international community to judge who the U.S. or international or the Western involvement in the invasion of East Timor.
Joan Evans, it's interesting as the U.S. bombs Afghanistan and talks about bringing Osama bin Laden to justice. It's been the U.S. that has opposed an international criminal court. Can you talk a little more about that in relation to East Timor?
That's right. I mean, the U.S. not only has opposed an international criminal court, but has done little to nothing to ensure that there be accountability for the people of East Timor, not only for the ground zero that occurred there in September 1999, but for the preceding 24 years of atrocities committed by the Indonesians. In January 2000, an International Commission of Inquiry in East Timor, a UN body, recommended that to the Security Council that there be established some sort of international tribunal to try gross human rights crimes committed in East Timor. But the United States and its allies in the Security Council instead deferred to Indonesia and allowed Indonesia to try its own, to prosecute its own. Well, it's been almost 2 years since that. The International Commission of Inquiry recommended the establishment of a tribunal, and there has not been an indictment of a single Indonesian military official by the Indonesian judicial system for crimes committed in East Timor. Now, even if the Indonesian process were to go forward, right, what we're talking about, if it were to be successful, would be the prosecution of only a handful of war criminals, of people who have committed crimes against humanity, because the Indonesian process envisions prosecution for crimes committed only in April and September 1999, and only crimes committed in three of East Timor's 13 districts, right? So the other 12 districts wouldn't be touched. The other months in 1999, forget about anything happening prior to 1999. So it's for that reason that there really needs to be a serious push, especially in the United States, to realize an international tribunal. Now, interestingly enough, in the days following the September 11th attacks against the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, among the first visitors to Washington, D.C. were Australian Prime Minister John Howard, Indonesia's new president, Megawati Sukarno-Putri, and then Washington's lead cheerleader for the current war effort against Afghanistan, British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Now, what all these heads of state have in common, along with President G.W. Bush, is that they lead countries that were all guilty, either directly or indirectly, in the making of Ground Zero in East Timor in September 1999 and the invasion and occupation that took place over a much longer period of time. Now, these are the same countries that are now advocating for a vigorous war against terrorism. In the case of the United States and Britain and Australia, they're actually making a war in Afghanistan. But these same countries, vis-a-vis their own crimes in East Timor, of course, not surprisingly, have little to nothing to say.
For the record, let's go for a minute to the tape. Well back in 1975, when U.S. approved Indonesia's invasion of East Timor again, then President Ford, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, went to Suharto and went to Indonesia and met with one of the longest reigning dictators in the world, General Suharto. This is what Ford, the former U.S. president, had to say.
Our relationship involves a common concern for the right of every nation to pursue its destiny on its own independent and sovereign course. On behalf of Mrs. Ford and myself, I raise my glass and propose a toast.
That was former U.S. President Ford. Your response, Joe?
Well, history knows what happened after that. It was just less than 24 hours later, I believe, that Indonesian military entered Dili through a brutal invasion, December 7th, 1975. December 7th, of course, in the United States is known as a day that will live in infamy, the attack on Pearl Harbor. But it should live in infamy in the United States also for other reasons, because of U.S. complicity and one of the great crimes against humanity in the 20th century.
Well,
interestingly enough, you know, Henry Kissinger, of course, as you mentioned, was present in East Timor, in Indonesia with Ford when the green light was given for the invasion. 24 years later, the ambassador to Indonesia was a man by the name of Stapleton Roy. And as the Indonesian military and its paramilitary proxies were engaging in the destruction and campaign of terror in East Timor that resulted in Ground Zero in September 1999, Stapleton Roy was asked to explain why Washington and other Western capitals weren't doing anything to stop the carnage. And he responded as follows. This is a quote. "The dilemma is that Indonesia matters and East Timor doesn't," end quote. What Roy does now, Stapleton Roy, he's the managing director of Kissinger Associates, a consulting firm, I believe based in New York City, founded by Henry Kissinger. So the circle of crime has come full circle.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all for being with us. Also, letting people know in the New York area, Constanzo and I, along with Michael Ratner, will be tonight, on Monday night, at Forum Justice for East Timor, 10 years after the Santa Cruz Massacre, and that's at 7:30 at 147 West 70th Street near Columbus, talking about the Santa Cruz Massacre. And Constanzo Pinto has come up from Washington, D.C. and Belagayo, so I want to thank you very much for joining us from Dili, East Timor. The latest news we have of the plane crash, again, the Pentagon at this point is saying we do not know that this has anything to do with terrorism. Everyone is, to say the least, very jittery, but there has been a major plane crash in New York. It happened in the Rockaways. A plane, an American Airlines flight headed to the Dominican Republic, has gone down just after it left Kennedy Airport, Flight 587, apparently more than 250 passengers and crew on board. As a result of this plane going down, apparently there was an explosion first before the plane went down. The engine fell off separately from the plane, causing two major fires in the Rockaways in Queens. A number of buildings are burning. Hundreds of firefighters have been dispatched. There are military planes flying overhead. Mayor Rudolph Giuliani has declared a level one alert here in New York City. It was an A300 Airbus that left Kennedy Airport on its way to the Dominican Republic. all tunnels coming into New York have been closed. The George Washington Bridge has been closed. The UN has partially been closed down at this point. Here in New York, we are on high alert, although we do not know what the cause of this plane crash has been, and we'll continue to bring you the latest. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we return, we're going to go to an anti-war rally that was held on Saturday night in Boston at the Orpheum Theater. It was a major speech given by Ralph Nader, along with union activists and others, talking about life as we know it after September 11th. And we'll bring you the latest news as we learn of it here in the firehouse in Chinatown, just blocks from the first Ground Zero, where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. We'll bring you the latest on what's happening in Queens, New York, with that crash. Stay with us.
Whether you're infected by greed, if you have to ask, then this song you really need. Greed is sneaky, hard to detect in myself. I see it so clearly in everybody else. I've been trying to find a way to talk about greed. I've been trying to find a way to talk about greed. I've been wondering if I could sing about greed. Trying to find a way to talk about greed. Now I can see it in you. You can see it in me. We can see it in big corporations all throughout the government. See it in the banks. I can see it in the military. See it in the church. I can see it in my neighbor. It all shows up so clearly. You and you and your greed. I've been trying to find a way to talk about greed. I've been trying to find a way to talk about greed. I've been wondering if I could sing about greed. Trying to find a way to talk about greed. I'm trying to find a way to talk about greed. Trying to find a way.
Talking about greed, Sweet Honey in the Rock here on the War and Peace Report. This is Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Again, the latest news, a plane has crashed in Queens. It is an American Airlines Flight 587 headed to the Dominican Republic. More than 250 people were on board. There's a level one alert in New York City. Fire trucks from all over the city have descended on the Rockaways where the plane went down. Two major fire sites, one where the engine went down, one where the plane went down. The United Nations has been partially closed. All the tunnels into the city have been closed. All three major airports, Newark Airport, LaGuardia Airport, and Kennedy, have been closed. We do not know the cause of this crash. Apparently, the plane lost contact soon after leaving Kennedy Airport. Looked like it was trying to circle back, and then it went down. We will continue to bring you the latest, but right now we're going to turn to Gary Nielsen, who is Vice President of Communication Workers America from Andover, Massachusetts. He spoke to thousands of people at an event at Orpheum Theater in Boston, where Ralph Nader spoke as well, talking about life after September 11th and talking about the state of the economy from a worker's perspective. This is Gary Nielsen.
I'm more used to standing on the street in front of a factory and with a megaphone, so this forum is a little bit out of touch for me, so you have to bear with me a little bit. But we'll start right in. Immediately following September 11th tragedy, another tragedy, more profound, happened. And that tragedy was the assault on the working people in this country and around the world. Today, businesses in the Bush White House are using the September 11th tragedy to push forward their assaults against working people. They have proclaimed that the renewed assaults on working people is the patriotic thing to do. They have labeled anyone who dare stand or speak out against these assaults against working people are anti-American and unpatriotic. And I assure you tonight, the only unpatriotic actions is to stand by and do nothing while we watch our jobs, livelihoods, incomes, be destroyed, outsourced, and taken away. Thank you. We watched as more than 100,000 airline workers lose their jobs, and Congress gives the airline industry $15 billion and nothing, nothing to workers. $15 billion for 4 days of lost operations and nothing to the workers who will lose their jobs forever. We watch as more than 500,000 workers lose their jobs around this country since September 11th, and Congress passes a corporate tax rebate package that would give companies billions of dollars of our money and nothing to workers. We watch as businesses in the Bush White House push forward this fast-tracked idea. Fast-tracked, the most undemocratic way of passing legislation, is being brought forward because it's a patriotic thing to do. And I will tell you here today, fast-track legislation is against everything we know as democratic. And we must not be fooled into believing it is good for the working people. It is bad. Thank you. Fast track will move these trade agreements forward to becoming law. Trade agreements that have no worker environmental protections written into them. These trade agreements that only protect business interests at the expense of workers and the environment. These trade agreements that have already cost us hundreds of thousands of jobs and will cost us hundreds of thousands of more. Decent living wage jobs move to other countries where companies can pay workers pennies a day, violate the most basic workers' rights, and create more poverty in the countries where these businesses set up shop. These trade agreements do nothing to offer decent employment, maintain living wage jobs, or bring people out of poverty. The only act to destroy workers, destroy families, and put children into factories and violate our environment. We must not accept any trade agreements that do not include enforceable worker and human rights and environmental protections. We must not be fooled into believing that accepting these agreements and legislation is the patriotic thing to do. We must not be fooled into believing that business interests are our interests, because they are not. We must not be fooled into believing that speaking out and having an opinion is anti-American. Because after all, America was founded and built on the idea that all people have a voice and all people have an opinion. And I say to you today that to try and silence us is the most unpatriotic and anti-American thing to do. I thank you.
And that was Gary Nielsen, the Communication Workers of America, speaking at a Ralph Nader rally for democracy on Saturday night at the Orpheum Theater in Boston. Thousands of activists gathered there. We're going to go to an insurance fraud expert talking about September 11th and who is benefiting in just a minute. And as we go to that, I just want to give people the latest. Again, an American Airlines jet with 255 people on board crashed today, this morning at about 9:17 in a residential neighborhood after taking off from New York's John F. Kennedy Airport. Flight 587 went down on its way to the Dominican Republic. It lost contact with the with air control just after it took off, and we're now going to go to the rally to hear Jason Adkins talk about insurance and insurance fraud.
I spend my living suing insurance companies. There's no shortage of work. Let me tell you, the insurance industry wants the public to think insurance is boring. You say the word insurance, you're supposed to turn off. We need you to turn on, because that's what affects the economy, every one of our lives, and health insurance and workers' coverage for injuries. And that's where $3 trillion of workers' monies are and consumers' monies are. We need to keep an eye on the insurance industry. They're looking for a multi-billion dollar handout from the federal government right now. The last time I heard, they believed in the free market. Every time we look for consumer protections, it's the free market. And now suddenly it's $10, $20, $40 billion of handouts. You can't stand. Now they have a bad reputation because they like to take money in and they don't like to pay it out. I mean, is anybody surprised that within a couple days of the World Trade Center fiasco and disaster, the insurers actually filed suit to avoid paying claims in that matter? It gets worse, although maybe not worse than that. Let me tell you what's going on locally, and I have only 3 minutes to describe for every minute a $3 billion aspect of this scandal. It's $10 billion a scam. It involves Liberty Mutual Insurance Company. That's an exciting name. But what is Liberty Mutual Insurance Company? It's 90 years old. It was started by workers and farmers to protect themselves and to return all profits to lower their cost of insurance and to make sure that Liberty Mutual, which is the largest underwriter of workers in case they're injured on the job, to make sure that those people would be compensated. There's a power grab going on, and the executives want to follow the tradition of the savings and loans and the banks that converted in the last 10 years and left communities, local communities without local banks, bought up by the fleets of the world, in which communities got nothing for literally millions of dollars in investments they made in those local community banks.
We're going to bring you more of Jason Adkins tomorrow on Democracy Now! We did not, to say the least, expect the interruptions that we've had today of breaking news throughout the morning. Again, the latest news we have this morning at 9:17, plane American Airlines Flight 587 crashed in Queens in the Rockaways with more than 255 people on board. It is unclear what caused this. The Pentagon says there at this point is no link to terrorism. The Federal Aviation Administration said all options are open at this time. We have very little information, limited information. Pentagon said surveillance flights were going on in the area. Nothing unusual had been spotted, but the plane did go down with more than 255 people. The UN is on partial lockdown. Tunnels into New York have been closed. Three major area airports, Newark, LaGuardia, and Kennedy, have been closed, and we'll keep you updated on the latest news. But that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! In Exile, produced by Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, and Chris Abrams. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. We're broadcasting from the Firehouse Engine 31, just blocks from the first Ground Zero, where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. We are at Downtown Community Television. And we will be back on the air tomorrow with the latest news of what has taken place today. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting in exile from WBAI, in exile from the embattled studios, in exile from the studios of the Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners. Thanks for listening.
Where we are born, we are human. don't I?